This is Talking History. Talking History is a weekly radio program focusing on history. It examines our past and how we recall it, how we preserve it, how we interpret it, and how we transform it into myth. Talking History is a co-production of the University at Albany History Department, State University of New York, WRPI-FM Troy, and the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska.
Welcome to Talking History. My name is Julian Zelizer, an assistant professor of history and public policy at the State University of New York at Albany. Today my guest is Douglas Brinkley. Dr. Brinkley is professor of history and a director of the Eisenhower Center at the University of New Orleans. He has written award-winning books on James Forrestal, Dean Acheson, and Franklin Roosevelt, and is a regular contributor to National Public Radio. His writing has also appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Atlantic Monthly. Today's conversation will be speaking about his most recent book, The Unfinished Presidency, Jimmy Carter's Journey Beyond the White House, which was recently published by Viking Press. Welcome to Talking History.
Thank you for having me on.
When did you become interested in becoming a political historian?
Well, I was interested in becoming a historian when I was a young boy. My mom and dad were high school teachers, so we would take family vacations across the country. And instead of going to SeaWorld and Disneyland, we would visit historic sites. So by the time I turned 15, I had visited Jefferson's Monticello or Truman's Independence, got to read The Grapes of Wrath, and then visit Steinbeck's home in Salinas. Was able to go to read Willa Cather and go to Red Cloud, Nebraska. So I think living on the road for family vacations 3 months in a trailer got me very interested in American history. I also became quite enamored with American folk figures. Jesse James, Billy the Kid, Johnny Appleseed, Paul Bunyan, you know, Pecos Bill, myth and reality in America. So when I started my undergraduate degree at Ohio State, I knew I wanted to be either a folklorist or a historian. And eventually I did my undergrad in history. And I became a diplomatic historian by training, Cold War diplomatic history at Georgetown University. That's really because I became a teacher's assistant to the diplomatic historian. And I wrote my dissertation on Dean Acheson, which I later turned into a book for Yale University Press. But now I really do a lot with the mixture of foreign policy and American politics. So I'm a diplomatic and political historian. But you know, one of the things that I'm trying to do in my own career now is trying to shake some of the labels we get pigeonholed as having to be something as historians. And I'm looking now to try to at least widen it to the self. I would consider myself a 20th century American historian. And there's a great deal of value, for example, right, looking at, as I've done, I direct the Eisenhower Center, I've written on Acheson and Dwight Eisenhower and Khrushchev and, you know, the 50s, but I also want to write on the civil rights movement of the 1950s, I want to write on the Beat Generation, you know, I want to kind of look at things from more of an American studies approach, that you'd look at the 20s or 30s or 40s, what went on in a particular era and why those things went on. So all the time I'm trying to expand out of my box of being a diplomatic political historian and trying to understand, at least during the Cold War period, some of the cultural and social waves and movements of that period.
In your most recent book, The Unfinished Presidency, you thank Arthur Schlesinger Jr. and Stephen Ambrose for their expert guidance on writing contemporary history. And I was curious what they taught you.
Well, both of them, I've been very lucky to have two mentors like Steve Ambrose and Arthur Schlesinger Jr. When I took over for Steve Ambrose as director of the Eisenhower Center, when Steve retired, he asked me to take over for him. I got to know him a long time, and I see him almost every day when he's down in New Orleans, which is most of the year, so we've become good friends. And what I learned from Steve is the importance of writing history, that sometimes when we go do our PhDs and we're in graduate school, we learn about the footnotes, which is so important, and how to conduct research properly in historiography. But what we don't get taught enough is writing. I really regret that my PhD program didn't force me to take journalism classes and composition courses, because you know, you want to communicate what you're writing. It's not, I mean, you want to have some people read what you're doing, more than just 10 colleagues that, and then you go to a OAH meeting and discuss it. You know, I think that we're dealing, you know, there's such a thing as being a public historian, and I think I've learned from both Ambrose and Schlesinger the importance of at least trying to not lose your footnotes, not lose your serious research, but at least make your writing work on improving your writing all the time, so it's a little more accessible to more people. Because, you know, we as we all know, you're a history professor. I mean, we have to be on a mission to teach history in some ways. We have to want it to be exciting for people. We know, because this is our profession, what could be more wonderful than being a historian. But I feel, and I think Arthur and Steve sometimes feel, that we're not doing enough to keep exciting people about local history, about the history of our nation, no matter what it might be, no matter what the topic might be. And so I've learned from Schlesinger and Ambrose that that prose counts, that it is important, and that a good book is a readable book. You know, many of the best people writing history today in our field, political history if you like, are journalists. I've learned as much from reading Robert Caro's books on Lyndon Johnson, or David Halberstam on The Best and the Brightest around the 1950s, or Doris Kearns Goodwin, on FDR and Eleanor, David McCullough. These are not academically trained historians, yet they're writing the big history books in some ways of our area in political history. So I always ask myself, what can I do to bring my skills as a trained, serious academic, but not dismiss these journalistic historians who have a much smoother narrative style? How does one learn to merge those so you come up with a style that makes your book both readable and historically accurate?
And how did you decide to focus this book on Carter's post-presidential period?
I started wanting to do a biography of Jimmy Carter. I was from Atlanta originally, and I've always found Jimmy Carter interesting. I thought he was a great American story. I also thought that there were aspects of his presidency that were underappreciated. I mean, after all, this was, you know, Camp David, Panama Canal treaties, recognizing the People's Republic of China, overseeing the transition of Rhodesia to Zimbabwe, trying to create a sane energy policy, 4 years of not going to war, an attempt to balance the budget, which was unpopular with liberals in his party, the Alaska Lands Act, which saved land three times the size of California, one of the great environmental acts, conservation acts ever in American history. So I started seeing his human rights policy, which I thought got pummeled a lot when he was president, but to me had a lot of merit. So I thought he was a political failure as president, but I thought there were virtues to his 4 years. And I decided I was going to write a full biography of him, either one volume or a couple volumes. Well, I started doing that, and I started writing about his early years in Plains and interviewing people and bringing him up to the governorship when President Carter was making headline news in Bosnia, Haiti, and North Korea. And everywhere I went, like I'm here in Albany, I'd giving talk tonight at the university. When I would give those talks, people would always start at being more interested in what he's been doing lately, what he's done out of office. And I started seeing that one of the great stories of Carter is how he resurrected himself as a great ex-president, how he used the White House as a stepping stone for greater accomplishment. And when I mentioned my interest in this post-presidency, President Carter told me he'd let me see his diaries, his travel reports, and open up all of his post-presidential archive. And I would be able to travel with him to Sudan or to Israel or to Haiti and watch what he does, whether it's in monitoring election or trying to make peace in the Middle East or working on agricultural efficiency program in Africa. And that would be a unique perspective, and I couldn't turn that down. I thought, I'm young enough now, I'm 37, so I thought I'll never regret in my life, years from now, that I had that opportunity to travel some with President Carter as a historian and watch what he does and be able to bring that experience into the classroom as a teacher, and it proved to be very valuable. I made it no strings attached that I'd write whatever book I wanted. He would give me as many interviews as I needed. And he just said, write the best you can. So I thought it was a very rare opportunity to do a kind of book that I had not originally planned to do. And it turned out quite well, because I'm very pleased with the Unfinished Presidency and the reviews that it's received from the academic and journalistic community in America. And I think it's an important book on looking at what one does out of office, which is always a big question. I get asked a lot now, I'm like an authority on X's, What's Bill Clinton going to do when he leaves? What is, on and on.
There's one of the things that comes out in the book is the importance of Carter's personal relations with leaders, both as president and in the next 10 years or so. One of the stories you tell is when Carter visited the district of a representative from Indiana, John Bradamus, and he delivered a historic speech on human rights, and he didn't mention Bradamus's name. And he later told you, or he said in an interview, "I was on Nixon's enemies list, but he never treated me that way." And I was curious, from your work, how much did that affect his success and failure as president?
It killed him as president. I mean, just think about Jimmy Carter. Rick Hertzberg, who was a Carter speechwriter and now is an editor at The New Yorker, said that Jimmy Carter's the closest we've ever come to picking a president out of the phone book. I mean, in 1976, nobody really knew who Jimmy Carter was. And he came out of nowhere. He ran as the anti-politician. "I'm not Watergate. I'm not Vietnam War. I had no part in Nixon's Supreme Court appointments on Capitol Hill. You know, I'm not part of the Medicaid or Medicare debate. I'm the anti-Washington candidate." And he believed his own campaign. That was brilliant campaign populist politics that brought him to Washington. And he walked down Pennsylvania Avenue on the inaugural, got out of his car, and there was this great expectation. But the truth is, Washington's a political town, and Carter did not know how to play it. He quickly alienated the Ted Kennedy liberal wing of his own party, so much so that Kennedy challenged him for the presidency in 1980. He alienated the Scoop Jackson wing, the more conservative wing. He would barely communicate with his own leaders on Capitol Hill. He felt that compromise was somehow dirty Jimmy Carter, that backslapping and cocktail parties were grotesque, shallow endeavors. He refused to play the game of politics. You know, in politics, you have to be a sailor, like Franklin Roosevelt or John Kennedy, Bill Clinton, or Democratic sailors, where you know you have to weave and go and cast and, with the wind to get to your point of destination. Jimmy Carter was a nuclear submariner who would go from point A to point B. "I want to do this." And this served him very well on pushing the Panama Canal treaties through, or his stubborn tenacity at Camp David. But when it came to the compromise, the art of compromise in politics, he just refused to engage. Hence, his biggest sin as president was allowing, from a Democratic point of view, allowing Ronald Reagan to win in 80 and bringing in 12 years of Republican reign, which simply overturned a lot of policies he believed in. So his own stubbornness and his own, the example you gave of John Bradamus in Indiana, you know, it's a very important congressman. He's standing on the platform and you don't even recognize him and you're in his district. This was classic Carter, and it makes one of the reasons he's even today he's disliked in the Democratic National Committee. He's disliked within the party apparatus. He has Democratic political friends. Sam Nunn's a friend, Al Gore's a friend, but by and large they think Carter is a loner who was interested in his own place in history and not building a Democratic Party. Carter said upon entering office in 1977, "The Democratic Party is an albatross around my neck." You can't do that. You have to be your leader. Yes, you're the leader of the United States and the American people, but as president, you also have to be the political leader of your party. And Carter refused to do that, and it cost him dearly.
Did it affect his relations in the 80s in terms of foreign leaders in trying to conduct foreign policy? Did those personal problems emerge as well?
No, because one of the things, Carter was not afraid to criticize the United States government in the 80s, and they loved that abroad. A former American president like Carter, who would criticize Ronald Reagan all the time abroad, was something that the foreign audience loved. And of course, Carter wasn't running for anything. He didn't have, remember when Carter was dealing as ex-president with foreign leaders, he was representing himself for the Carter Center. He didn't have to represent something as big and multi-dimensional as the Democratic Party. So his relationship with foreign leaders has always been very strong and very good. They see him as, generally speaking, there are exceptions, but as an honest man, an honest broker, person with a lot of integrity, and a person who, if you'd like, speaks the global language of the United Nations, human rights, a kind of a concern for the global poor, a need for the rich countries to give more to the poor countries, a proponent of global aid, international aid. He's seen as a kind of sane human rights internationalist globally. And you know, so he's a very, very, he's much more admired on foreign shores than he is in the United States, Jimmy Carter, today.
Do you think some of the problems of his presidency influenced his agenda in the post-presidential years, particularly the rescue mission in Iran?
Well, one of the things I had to grapple with was the Iranian hostage, you know, the situation. Let's face it, Jimmy Carter bungled it badly. All the, you know, 53 American hostages, and America, it was as if America was held hostage month after month, and Carter didn't know what to do. But from a perspective of time, I do have to take Jimmy Carter's view and at least consider what he says. What were my other options short of bombing, doing a bombing raid, which would have either killed all the hostages and would have killed civilians in Tehran, could have created a war in the region? My strategy, or maybe I should have done things different, I brought all the hostages back alive. Every single one of them is back here living their life in America. And that meant something to Jimmy Carter, probably too much so. That's where one of the things I explore in the Unfinished Presidency is how religion plays in Jimmy Carter's decision making. I was stunned to find out that during the the rescued attempt, which failed. Now, if Carter would have succeeded in that rescued attempt, if there would have been a couple extra helicopters and that mission worked, he could have easily gotten reelected, I think, or would have had a much better chance with the hostages back. But I was stunned to realize that in the meetings with the head of the NSC and the Pentagon, Jimmy Carter asked the top, his military brass, if you like, there, all right, when we rescue them, can we use rubber bullets so we don't have to kill one of the Iranian guards? He didn't even want to kill a single Iranian guard in this rescue mission. We can respect that as a humanist, as somebody who treasures human life, as somebody who's sane in the sense of not wanting bloodshed. But I think one has to question if that's what we want a commander-in-chief, that at that kind of thinking at that moment of crisis, you know, you sometimes have to sacrifice people for a bigger objective. But I think that Carter's policy, if the option was bombing Tehran or doing what Carter did, negotiating them out, I would take the Carter solution, even though it cost him a political election and cost the United States a mild degree of embarrassment for a period of a year. I think that's a saner policy than just bombing the hell out of Tehran.
And in the 1980s, he seems to focus more on international policy from the book than domestic policy. And when he dealt with domestic issues, it's more through Habitat for Humanity, either voluntary or local issues. And I was curious, why do you think he made that decision?
Because foreign policy was where his greatest achievements were as president. And in 1982, when he's trying to decide what to do with the rest of his life, he's a hyperactive guy, Jimmy Carter, loads of energy, perfect health. He was in his mid-50s. You know, he had 30 more years of public life. What do I do with it kind of attitude. And they realized that the thing to do is build on Camp David, that somehow that conflict resolution, when Carter started understanding that right now or at any given moment there are about 35 civil wars going on in the world, that means 1,000 battle-related deaths a year, and that the UN was too burdened to deal with them, plus the UN's not allowed to deal with the internal affairs of countries, and that there was such a thing as track to diplomacy, that Jimmy Carter, taking his credibility as an honest peace broker, could possibly weigh in on some of these civil wars and try to get these sides that weren't talking to talk peace, to lay down rifles for a ceasefire and to at least sit and get a dialogue going. He believed that if you can get a dialogue going between bitter enemies, peace is possible. And he wanted to make that a hallmark of his life. He was going to dedicate his life to that. Well, that expanded to democratic elections, to monitoring democratic elections. It was Jimmy Carter who was the election highest profile election monitor in Panama in 1989 when Manuel Noriega ran a fraudulent election. Jimmy Carter, nobody believed that the United States government when they said Noriega was running a fraudulent election because nobody in Latin America believed Washington. But when Jimmy Carter said Noriega's run a dishonest election, the OAS believed him, all the Latin American countries believed him, the world believed Jimmy Carter. Everybody knew that it was a fraudulent election. And that's the moral credibility Carter had. And so, and then after doing that first election in Panama, he then the next year went to Nicaragua in 1990. And he was the one when Daniel Ortega and the Sandinistas lost to Chamorro in 1990. It was Carter who was there as election monitor and went to Danny and said, look, Danny, I've lost elections. There's life after it. And Ortega stepped down, bringing democracy to Nicaragua because he trusted and believed and liked Jimmy Carter. Because Carter had developed a relationship with Ortega of one of respect and friendship. And so Ortega stepped down in democracy, and Chamorro was able to come into Nicaragua. After that, there you're dealing with a dozen other elections Carter's monitored around the world. Sometimes he's in Togo, sometimes Liberia, the Dominican Republic. You can barely find it in the New York Times. It'll be in a box buried in page 28. But, you know, Carter has really put himself on the line internationally in election monitoring and on conflict resolution with a lot of success and a fair amount of failure. But the lesson I found writing and studying him was that he's trying. And here's a former president not sitting on corporate boards getting millions. Here's a former president not worrying about his golf handicap, but it's taking this background that we elected him to be a president, and the Secret Service that he has and the pension he has, and is applying it to try to make the world a better place. And generally speaking, he's done that. I can tell you, by writing direct letters to dictators around the world, he's gotten thousands of political prisoners out of jail, working with Amnesty International behind the scenes with no cameras, no media glare. And so his record out of office is important, because I think the more we talk about what Carter's doing, it sets the bar for other presidents. I mean, if Bill Clinton wants to go down as the next president, he's going to have to look at what Jimmy Carter did. And he's going to have to say, well, I just can't hang around with Steven Spielberg in Hollywood and make a lot of money, that I won't look good in history. And I think Carter joins John Quincy Adams, probably, as one of our nation's two great ex-presidents. And neither Carter or Quincy Adams were considered particularly good presidents.
Following on that, one of the themes of your book is Carter's role in the Middle East during that period. That's one of his defining issues. And one of the issues that troubled critics of Carter was his ability to have a relationship with dictatorial leaders in Syria, for example, yet publicly display much more of a hostility toward the Israeli government during this period. And I was wondering, how did he resolve that tension?
I think one place that Jimmy Carter has not been particularly effective as ex-president is his efforts to continue the Camp David peace accords in the Middle East. I think what occurred is he got very frustrated with the Israeli government. He always was close to Sadat, first off, at Camp David. Sadat's like a brother to him. And once Sadat got assassinated in October 81, Carter decided if Sadat gave his life to peace in the Middle East, I'm going to dedicate my life to peace in the Middle East. But as the 1980s wore on, the Reagan years, and I think that the turning point for Carter is December 1987 with the Intifada, he started sympathizing with the Palestinian teenagers throwing the stones, the so-called nonviolent resistance movement. It did turn violent in many ways. And I think he saw that the Palestinians were an underdog, that weren't being properly represented in the United States, that in America you had a large Jewish lobby, you had a great interest in trade with Israel, military trade with Israel, and that the Palestinians were the equivalent of African Americans, blacks in the South during the Jim Crow period. They were having third-class rights in Israel. But Carter got himself, I felt, into great... I think he really misplayed it a lot there, because he got really seduced by Yasser Arafat in the sense that I think Carter was right when he started understanding as early as like when they met in Paris in April of 1990. I think Carter was right in his assessment that Arafat was the key to peace in the Middle East, that he did represent the Palestinian people and that you had to recognize the PLO. And I think Carter was ahead of that. But I think he underestimated that Arafat had a really unsavory side to a lot of his past, that he really was a terrorist in his earlier incarnations, that it wasn't clear that he could be fully trusted. And he felt that what Carter did was put all of his money, he lost his role as a fair broker in the Middle East by seeming to be overwhelmingly on Arafat's side. How so? Well, he always criticized Tel Aviv, the Israeli government's human rights policies, but he never would criticize publicly the human rights policies of Saudi Arabia or Syria. So it started looking like he was singling out Israel in the Middle East to criticize instead of applying a more general. And I asked him about this, and he said, well, because Israel's a democracy, and if you want to change a human rights policy, you go to the press. You speak publicly. In Syria, which is a totalitarian society run by Assad, if you want to get political prisoners out, you have to go to Assad and say, can you get these people out? If you go to the media, there is no media and it won't work. And his goal was to get certain people that were in prison out that shouldn't have been. So publicly it looked like he felt he was beating up on Israel, but he would say, my documents will show I was equally hard privately on Assad. That's an explanation, but you can understand why if you were in the Israeli government, you would start feeling that Carter was somewhat prejudiced in the sense of siding with the Palestinians' effort to control the West Bank and Gaza, and which was okay because you look at Carter now as sort of a spokesperson in some ways for the Palestinian cause, but not as somebody that you could have sit down and lead a negotiation team. They would never accept him in Tel Aviv. There are some people, Ezra Weizman would take Carter, Shimon Peres might, but the Likud party just loathes Jimmy Carter. I mean, they find him to be one of the most reprehensible and meddlesome of recent American diplomatic figures. They look at him sort of like George Ball, who was also very critical of the Israeli government. So I don't think Carter's been, the only way Carter's been effective in the Middle East in his ex-presidency is helping to give Arafat a kind of credibility heading into Oslo so Arafat could become a Nobel Peace Prize winner. Carter did a lot to meet him and try to rehabilitate his image in the Western world from terrorist to peacemaker. And one of the controversial parts of my book, which made kind of headline news, it was the front story in the Boston Globe, Carter wrote a speech for Arafat, which is almost unbelievable. He drafted the language because he felt Arafat was saying language that he didn't understand would play terribly into the West, that he had to learn how to play Western media better. And Carter started coaching him both through letters and correspondence and in person. So it's a fascinating relationship, Carter and Arafat. But it's the one place I can say that I think he has, at this point, is unable to play any kind of meaningful role.
How have you found the challenge of writing history that ends today, that ends in current events?
It's both, I don't like it. I mean, I think I'm not sure I would want to do another book like this. I thought I looked at it as a one-time opportunity, an experiment, and it worked. I had it ended in 1998. I ended the book in February of 98 when the Monica Lewinsky scandal broke out and Carter was in the Clinton White House and Clinton asked Jimmy Carter to pray for him. And that was their last time they'd met personally. So I brought it up to that point, but then what I'm going to eventually do here is which I'm already working on, is a full biography of Carter, which will come out maybe after he's no longer with us, or I'm not sure how long it'll take, but that will go to the end of his life and cover his whole career into one volume. But this was a kind of a contemporary history book based on an archive that's never been open, and that's the fascination with it. I got to see all this recent correspondence to Gorbachev and Mandela and Bishop Tutu and Margaret Thatcher and on of world leaders in the last 25 years, I just couldn't turn that opportunity down to take a look at that kind of collection.
Have you heard from President Carter about how you wrote?
He was
his
angry about the book when it first came out. Not angry, but it might be too strong a word. But the news media picked up on about three or four of the controversial parts of the book the book in general is a very praiseworthy. Yeah, I think Carter comes out looking good, and most of the reviews said that. And I think once the reviews came out, and some of the first, you know, Katie Couric on the Today Show, you know, picking on one controversial part my whole time on the Today Show, that's what she focused on. You know, that's today's media. But once the serious reviews in the New York Times and the Washington Post and Foreign Affairs came out, I think Carter got more comfortable. And once he got feedback saying, you know, what a positive book, I didn't know you did that much during all this period of your life. So I got married September 12th, and on my wedding day, I had over my fax machine, the morning I woke up, a long handwritten letter from President Carter telling me about his 52 years of marriage with Rosalynn and wishing me a great marriage and to come visit him when I'm back in Plains. And so at the end of it, it turned out pretty well.
Well, this is, again, Professor Douglas Brinkley. The book is The Unfinished Presidency, Jimmy Carter's Journey Beyond the White House, which has been published by Viking Press. Thank you for joining us on Talking History.
Well, thanks for having me.
Hello, this is Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Much has been written and said about the Jewish Holocaust, perhaps the most tragic event of the 20th century. Yet there's still so much we don't understand. How could such a thing have ever happened? And what was it like to experience such systematic and devastating acts of hostility? In a few moments, we'll take one step closer to answering the second question when we talk to historian Marian Kaplan about her new book, Between Dignity and Despair, Jewish Life in Nazi Germany. But first, let's look back at this week in history. The date was November 19th, 1863. The event, a speech that lasted only 2 minutes. The occasion, the dedication of a national cemetery at the site of the Battle of Gettysburg. The principal speaker, Harvard's Edward Everett, completed his two-hour oration, and President Abraham Lincoln was called upon to provide some concluding remarks. Those brief remarks, now known as the Gettysburg Address, took the nation by storm, and when he assured the American people that those who had died at Gettysburg had not died in vain, but rather to ensure that government of the people, by the people, and for the people would not perish from the earth. Turning to this week's history in the news, the recently released diary of President Kennedy's private secretary, Evelyn Lincoln, is adding a new, more personal dimension to her understanding of America's slain leader. It recounts everything from conversations between Kennedy and other famous leaders to private moments in the president's residence where, Ms. Lincoln notes, he practices speeches while bathing. Japanese Prime Minister Keizo Obuchi has offered his nation's apologies for Japan's colonial occupation of Korea from 1910 to 1945. Included in a joint declaration by the two countries, the Prime Minister stated that the Japanese humbly accepted the historical fact that Japanese colonial rule inflicted unbearable damage and pain on the Korean people and expressed remorseful repentance and heartfelt apologies for the ordeal. And relating to our interview today on the Holocaust, a cross-planting campaign at the former Nazi death camp, Auschwitz, is straining relations between Jews and Catholics. In a field next to the death camp, Catholics have collected a sea of crosses to honor those Christians who lost their lives at the site. Jews, who accounted for more than 90% of the 1.5 million victims at Auschwitz, viewed the display as a disrespectful intrusion on what is the largest Jewish cemetery in the world. You are listening to Talking History. The Jewish Holocaust was Adolf Hitler's final solution to the so-called Jewish problem in Europe. It resulted in the deaths of 6 million Jews and broken lives for many more. But what was it like to be a Jew and a woman living through such a horrendous period? That's the subject of our interview for this week, in which Talking History's Eileen Dugan talks to historian Marian Kaplan.
It is easy to look at the past with 20/20 hindsight. Case in point, the plight of the Jews in Germany in the 1930s. When they learn of the increased anti-Semitism of this period, the official laws methodically stripping Jews of their rights, and the personal day-to-day hostility which they endured, most people today ask, didn't the Jews see the writing on the wall? Why didn't they leave then, before the Holocaust could even begin? Historians, however, must free themselves from the habit of hindsight and must attempt to see the world through the eyes of those who lived at the time. Dr. Marion Kaplan, professor of history at Queens College of the City University of New York, has accomplished this difficult feat in her recent book, Between Dignity and Despair, Jewish Life in Nazi Germany. Professor Kaplan, whose own parents fled Nazi Germany, pays particular attention to the actions of Jewish women in the 1930s, providing a new perspective upon the anguishing social death of the Jews, which she demonstrates was an absolute prerequisite for the final solution. Welcome, Professor Kaplan.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
First, let's begin with this question of what was the status of the Jews in Germany before 1933?
Well, first we have to start off with the fact that Jews were a tiny, tiny minority. About 500,000 Jews, about 1%, under 1% of the population. And like every minority, they had a career profile that differed significantly from that of the general population. They had been historically prohibited from participating in a variety of economic endeavors and wound up mostly in business and commerce, so that about over 60% of Jews worked in business and commerce. They mostly lived in the cities. They were an urban population. About 80% lived in the cities. A third of Jews lived in Berlin. Many of them were also involved in the professions, so that if you look at lawyers, for example, even though Jews were only 1% of the German population, they were about 16% of the legal and 10% of the medical professions. So they had a very stark career profile that was different from others. In fact, if you were going to compare them to any group, you would compare them possibly to American Jews today.
Now, how did all of this begin to change, both publicly and privately, with the rise of Hitler?
Well, to begin with, the Nazis came to power in January 1933, and immediately it began to change. In April of that year, for example, the Nazis passed what was known as what we call the April Laws, which were laws that excluded Jews from the medical profession, the legal profession, the civil service, in which they were not highly represented anyway, since the civil service was pretty anti-Semitic at the time. But it excluded them from major fields of endeavor. They set quotas on schools for Jewish children, on universities and schools of higher learning. In that year, in that same first year, the Chamber of Culture excluded Jews from film, theater, music, fine arts, literature, journalism, areas in which Jews had been disproportionately active. So within the first year, there were legal exclusions and important economic boycotts. The Nazis declared a boycott of all Jewish businesses and professionals on April 1st of 1933. And although that wasn't a major Nazi success, it was the beginning of sporadic and continuous boycotts against Jewish businesses, so that many smaller businesses, the mom-and-pop shops, were forced to close down in very few years.
What about on a personal level? How did things begin to change for Jews on a personal level?
On a personal level, there were three elements that I point to. The reactions of strangers, the reactions of neighbors, and that of friends. Strangers began to point out who looked like a Jew on a bus or on a tram. In fact, they often got it wrong because Jews looked very much like other people, like other Germans. But there was the stereotype that the German, the Aryan, what they call themselves, was a blonde-haired, tall, blue-eyed person, and the Jews were dark and short. And of course, nobody ever fits into every stereotype. If you look at Hitler, he was dark and short. And so there would be strangers pointing out, you know, this person looks Jewish or that person looks Jewish, and of course sometimes getting it right and frightening Jews from appearing in public very often. Neighbors who had been collegial, friendly, sociable for years, sometimes for generations, stopped talking to Jews. And friends gradually began to turn away, so that by 1935, just within 2 years, non-Jewish friends became a rarity.
How do Jews perceive these changes, especially the Jewish women? How do they react to these changes?
Well, it's interesting because what I find here is a gender difference. Jewish women react very strongly to personal slights when the postman looks through them, when the neighbor doesn't say good morning, when a child loses a non-Jewish friend because they call him a dirty Jew or something like that. Whereas the men tend to look much more closely and tend to react much more to public pronouncements, political pronouncements, radio announcements, to the legal dimension of German anti-Semitism. So that if my image in my mind is a wife coming to her husband and saying, Johnny got beaten up on the way home from school today, and the husband saying, yes, but the Nazis have decreed that, you know, now Jews can live in Germany with these disabilities and they won't touch us anymore. So they were always looking at different things. Their antenna were tuned to different kinds of different clues.
Well, at this point, of course, there comes that inevitable question. The laws were being promulgated, strangers were turning against them, even friends that they'd known for years began turning against the Jews. If things were getting so much worse for them, a person with 20/20 hindsight now says, why didn't they start to leave Germany in great numbers?
Well, there are a couple of important reasons. The first is that in the 1930s, there was a worldwide depression. And the nations that were, you know, possible nations of refuge didn't want new immigrants. And so it was very, very hard to get into another country. That's the first, probably the most important reason, way more important than Jewish perceptions, because once Jews did perceive the danger, which was in November 1938, they still couldn't get in. They couldn't have gotten in 35 any easier than they could have gotten in 38. So that's the first part, that nations of refuge closed their doors. But there are other important reasons, too. How many Americans today, perceiving discrimination against them, would necessarily pick up, lock, stock, and barrel, move to a strange country with a new language, and take that risk? How many people would do that? How many fathers, how many breadwinners today, of course, women and men are breadwinners, but in those days, mostly the fathers, the husbands, how many breadwinners would risk that? They would prefer to risk staying and putting up with more disabilities than forging a brand new path in the midst of a depression. Some of these professionals were business people, and to get out of Germany and to start a new business, they would have needed something called money, but the Germans blocked all Jewish bank accounts and took all Jewish property, so that it was very hard to come to a new nation penniless with a family. So I think those are important reasons why they stayed. There's also confusion in the 1930s. There's one story I tell about a young woman whose father in 1935 is asked to come down to City Hall to get an award for having been a World War I veteran, and he's given this award, this Jewish man is given an award with a swastika on it. So there are all these mixed signals going on. Then in 1936 you have the Great Olympics in Berlin, and right before the Olympics the Nazis go much more easily on Jewish on anti-Semitic laws and decrees because they want to put a good face out to the rest of the world. So in the 1936 period, although there are still the economic boycotts, there's less vitriolic anti-Semitic decrees, attacks, etc. There are fewer of those against Jews. And so again, people look at these mixed messages and they prefer the message that says we can live here even though we are going to be increasingly disabled. I should add that Jews had just become emancipated in Germany by the 1870s. All right, 1866, 1870, they became equal citizens. So some Jews saw the Nazis as a step backwards, but not as a brand new step into the unknown.
Now, what did Jewish women do in the mid-1930s to try to survive in this increasingly hostile environment?
They took a very, very active role because Jewish men tended to be physically abused, often arrested, tortured, beaten up by the Nazis. So Jewish women took a much more active public role than they had ever before in their histories. They represented their men to the authorities. They represented their husbands to the Gestapo, which was the secret police, to the finance offices, to the emigration offices. They did a lot of the public mediation. between their families and the government. They took jobs when their husbands' business began to fail or when their husbands were fired. These were mostly middle-class women, a very small proportion of whom ever really worked outside the home, and suddenly they began to work outside the home. They began retraining for jobs in countries of emigration. As the 1930s continued onwards, there was emigration, so that you have 20,000, 30,000 people emigrating per year, and Jewish women looked for jobs that would be useful in lands of emigration, mostly as domestic household help, as seamstresses, as tailors, as people who could, you know, basically stitch together a livelihood in the new country. They also interceded for their children at school, and they continually pressed their husbands and brothers and fathers to emigrate. Jewish women clearly wanted to emigrate well before Jewish men were willing to consider that. And I think that has to do with men being breadwinners, as I said before.
What was the life like for children during this period?
Well, it depended. If a child went to a Jewish school or to a non-Jewish school, if it went to a public school with many non-Jews, there was almost immediate discrimination by teachers, and often, very often, by other children, so that many of the Jewish children felt friendless and abandoned. This depended, though, again, on whether they lived in small towns and villages or in big cities. In Berlin, the stories are less horrible. There are more children who were able to find friends or maintain friends for a longer period of time. In the small towns, they were terribly ostracized, especially in the playgrounds, during their recesses where nobody would talk with them. If they went to Jewish schools, they lived in a kind of fake oasis where they learned new languages for emigration, English, French, and Hebrew, where they learned sometimes for the first time about Jewish history and Jewish culture, because Jews were highly acculturated into German society, and many of them had lost some contact with, you know, with Hebrew, with Jewish religion and Jewish tradition. So sometimes the Jewish schools brought this back for Jews in a kind of sense of elan, in a sense that they were, that they should learn a little bit about their history so that they could be proud of their history rather than feel bad about themselves, which is what the Nazis, of course, wanted them to feel.
Now, how on a personal level did Jews react to the November pogrom of 1938 or the deportations, the rumors of genocide?
Well, I'd have to break that down. The November pogrom was clearly the signal to get out. After the pogrom, almost everyone tried to get out. And those who didn't get out were stuck there because, as I really emphasize over and over again, most countries didn't let them in. They were old, they were poor, they didn't think they could start a new life. About 80% of young people under the age of 25 did get out. When I say get out, about two-thirds of German Jews actually left Germany, not all to safety, because some of them went to European countries where they were later caught. They emigrated to France or to Holland or to Belgium. They were deported later on to the camps in the east. But about 50% actually managed to get out to safety. So I think that emigration really picks up after the November pogrom, and continues to pick up, but the Nazis ultimately shut all doors in October 1941, and forbid emigration, because by that time they've turned their thoughts toward annihilation. So that's the November pogrom. In terms of the deportations and the rumors of genocide, at the beginning of my book, I quote from Leo Tolstoy, who says, and I want to quote it here too, "At the advent of danger, there are always two voices that speak in the human heart. One invites consideration of the nature of the peril and the means of escaping it. The other argues that it is not in man's power to foresee everything." And I think that's exactly the split among German Jews. There were those who said, we have to flee, we're in danger. It was not clear that they were going to be annihilated, but by 1942 there were strong rumors to that effect as well. We have to go into hiding. And there were those who, hearing some of the same rumors, thought that it couldn't be that bad, that they were going to be deported to work camps, to labor camps, and that was the worst of it. So they either didn't know or denied what they heard.
Yeah, we have only a minute remaining, but perhaps you could quickly tell us why it is important to understand the experiences of Jewish women in particular in the Nazi period.
I think that what's really important here is that there are very important gender differences in the way people react to persecution and in the way they are persecuted. The Nazis persecuted Jewish men more harshly at first, leaving the mistaken belief that women weren't going to be touched. I think that they react very differently. Women wanted to flee earlier, and in fact, in the end, more women remained. So I think there are all kinds of reasons why we should look at men and women in danger and not assume that they will react simply as a human being, but they react as they are socialized as men and women.
All right, well, we're out of time, I'm afraid. Thank you, Professor Kaplan.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking to Professor Marian Kaplan, professor of history at Queens College of the City University of New York, about her monograph, Between Dignity and Despair, Jewish Life in Nazi Germany.
Welcome back, and following up on Marian Kaplan's remarks, our site of the week for this program also relates to the Jewish Holocaust. And here to describe it for us is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
The Yad Vashem, located on the Mount of Remembrance in Jerusalem, was established in 1953 by an act of the Israeli Knesset. The 45-acre complex of museums, monuments, and research centers is not only one of the oldest, but is also one of the most impressive and instructive memorials to the Jewish people who died in the Holocaust. To learn more about this site, visit Yad Vashem's homepage at www.yad-vashem.org. If you can't make it to Jerusalem, the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. has plenty to offer visitors on the Holocaust. More than 10 million people have visited the museum since it opened 5 years ago.
Thank you, Cindy. Earlier in our show, Marian Kaplan talked about women in the Jewish Holocaust. But what about women in the other Holocausts of history? Was their experience the same? Here to comment on women in the Cambodian Holocaust of the mid-1970s is Elizabeth Che. Che is a Cambodian-American writer who lives in Norwalk, California. A reporter for the Orange County Register, she's been collecting stories and writing about the Cambodian genocide for several years.
Our family often sat on our living room floor and shared stories. They were my version of campfire ghost stories, filled with mysticism and intrigue. Tales of trapped souls, haunting straw-roofed huts, ditches full of decaying bodies, floating soldiers in a blood-soaked Mekong River. They were stories of the Cambodian genocide. In my mind, they hung on the edge of reality and folklore, but they were all real. My aunts used to tell me how as girls they were more like boys, trapping field mice and river eels with makeshift bamboo traps. Girls as old as 18 did not menstruate because their bodies lacked nutrition. Both men and women worked long hours with only watery spoonfuls of rice porridge to hold their empty stomachs. Mothers told me stories of how they would force themselves to vomit because their breasts would no longer give milk. They cradled hungry babies, buried many. Cambodian women saw their husbands dragged off and beaten in the fields. Some women saw their fathers and sons bound and shot before they could shield the bullets with their own bodies. But much of that is hidden behind a soft, meditative smile. It is unspoken, unwritten, and accepted fate. Today, in America, Cambodian women are not touted as heroines. Instead, many are regarded as welfare moms, too lazy to find work or learn English, too busy breeding gangsters. A mother came to me in tears after her son had died in a drive-by shooting in Long Beach, California. Her words were simple. I struggled so hard to keep my family alive, dodging death in Cambodia, to have a son die of a bullet in America. These women share a common bond with Jews, Armenians, Rwandans, Native Americans. They are all victims of humanity's ugliest crime, Holocaust. Their stories seldom spread beyond living rooms and family histories, but their lessons need to be shared by the world.
You've been listening to Elizabeth Chay, a reporter for the Orange County Register. This is Talking History. And finally, we turn to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, films, television shows, museum exhibits, and other events that may be of interest to our listeners. On November 18th, PBS will take a 100-year leap back in time with the premiere of the 11th season of The American Experience. This season will begin with a 3-hour special titled America 1900, which will look at the nation at the dawn of the 20th century. Narrated by David McCullough, the show will explore the political events of the year, the flood of new technology that ushered in the century, and such pop culture topics as the rise of the five and dime store and ragtime music. Check your local listings for showtimes. And next month, watch for a new film at your local theater titled Shakespeare in Love. The film, based on the life of one of the world's most famous writers, stars Ben Affleck and Gwyneth Paltrow.
Talking History is a co-production of the History Department, University at Albany, State University of New York, WRPI-FM Troy, and the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska.